Mark Stein's Sunday Poems.
Here's some rhymes for the times as we go from bad to verse. I found last year's first COVID summer rather dispiriting. The flora and fauna looked the same, fish are jumping, the cotton is high, but for most people around the world, there were none of the sounds of summer, the peal of children's laughter, the thwack of ball on bat, whether cricket or baseball, according to taste, no music in the park, no parades, no fetes, no festivals. And through the silence, the eerie feeling that summer is never going to be quite the same again. As indeed in the second COVID summer in California, in Canada and Britain and many other places, it isn't. So I was thinking of a poem that suits my mood and remembered one of the very earliest English sonnets. In fact, by the man who invented what we now think of as the Shakespearean sonnet. And no, that wasn't Shakespeare. Instead, it was Henry Howard, Earl of Surrey, and thus son and heir of the third Duke of Norfolk. Lord Surrey was a well-connected man, a descendant of King Edward I on his dad's side and King Edward III on his mum's. His sister was married to Henry VIII's illegitimate son, Henry Fitzroy, Duke of Richmond. His cousins included two of Henry VIII's queens, Anne Boleyn and Catherine Howard, for neither of whom marriage to the king ended well. This summer sonnet is the simplest thing, an accumulation of the familiar features of the season, the birds and bees, the fish and flowers, the snake shedding its slough, its skin. But the poet is depressed, and to be depressed in summer is worse than in autumn and winter when the landscape suits one's temper. Lord Surrey is the man who introduced to the English sonnet a very effective innovation, ending the 14 lines with a rhyming couplet, which formal device he uses absolutely brilliantly here. The poem is called The Soot Season, soot meaning sweet, and so I shall render it as such. I think the only archaism that isn't obvious is eek, as in also, the green hath clad both hill and vale. First published in the very first anthology of English poetry in 1557, Tottle's Miscellany, Songs and Sonnets of Henry Howard, Earl of Surrey, Sir Thomas Wyatt and others. By Lord Surrey, The Sweet Season. The sweet season that bud and bloom forth brings, with green hath clad the hill and eke the vale. The nightingale with feathers new she sings, the turtle to her mate hath told her tale. Summer is come, for every spray now springs, the hart hath hung his old head on the pale, the buck in brake his winter coat he flings, the fishes float with new repaired scale, the adder all her slough away she slings, the swift swallow pursueth the flies small, the busy bee her honey now she mings, winter is worn that was the flower's bale. And thus I see among these pleasant things, each care decays, and yet my sorrow springs. A poem from me to you by Henry Howard, Earl of Surrey. The sweet season, the sweet season. Lord Surrey was a reckless man and made the mistake of falling out with Henry VIII. He tried to persuade his sister Mary, the widow of Henry's illegitimate son, to seduce the king and thereby wield as much influence on him as Madame d'Etampes doth about the French king. Mary was outraged by the suggestion that she enter into some kinky relationship with her father-in-law, as if she were Mrs. Jerry Falwell Jr. being asked to seduce Jerry Falwell Sr. And the proposition led to Mary testifying against her brother at his trial for treason. He was convicted and beheaded on Tower Hill, not in sweet summer, but in the depths of winter, January 19th, 1547. He was 29 years old. Lord Surrey has the distinction of being the last man to be executed by order of Henry VIII. There are worse things than a bum summer. Here is a piece that was not performed until 15 years after the composer's death, but was written when he was a young man, Delius, and music for a summer evening. Composed in 1890 by Frederick Delius, Summer Evening, the first of his three small tone poems, played by the Royal Scottish National Orchestra, conducted by David Lloyd-Jones. Kamala Harris is said to be extremely irked at the way even, especially maybe, her fans cannot get her name right. Kamala. One way to fix it in your head is to remember other famous Kamalas. There's a Hindu goddess of that name, and also one half of the two most famous feral children in the British Empire back in the 1920s, Omala and Kamala, two sisters from Bengal, supposedly raised by wolves until they were discovered by a clergyman. Poetry-wise, the work I'd love to bring you is by the Indian nationalist Veer Savarkar, who was a man of action. In fact, he was charged as a conspirator in the assassination of Gandhi, but acquitted for lack of evidence. When the authorities in England put him on a boat back to India, he escaped through the porthole when the ship put in at Marseille, but was recaptured. So a man of action, but also a man of words, a poet. And when he was imprisoned on the Andaman Islands, where the international airport is now named after him, Veer Savarkar wrote many poems in the Mahathi language, scratched on his cell walls, including the epic work Kamala. But I have never seen a proper English translation. If you know of one, I'd love to hear about it, because all I've ever seen is only what is, I think, a rather flat literal translation, and doesn't really capture the character of the form of Mahathi poetry. Colours of love turn bloody red, and the garden of flowers is set on fire. Oh, my blossoming bacula, your fragrance is in vain. Oh, Kamala, your cries are in vain, and your beloved disappears. The royal beds are set on fire, and dreams turn into truth. Will Kamala's cries be in vain, or will her dreams turn into truth? Anyway, until a proper translation of that epic work from Veer Savarkar's incarceration in Andaman jail, scratched on his cell walls, until a proper translation of that comes along, here's a couple of poems from one of India's leading poets in English of recent years, Kamala Das, who late in life converted to Islam and became Kamala Saraya. This poem might come in useful for Kamala Harris if Joe Biden gets out of the basement and starts sniffing her hair. First published in 1967 in the collection The Descendants by Kamala Das, The Maggots. At sunset on the River Ban, Krishna loved her for the last time and left. That night in her husband's arms, Radha felt so dead that he asked, "What is wrong? Do you mind my kisses, love?" And she said, "No, not at all," but thought, "What is it to the corpse if the maggots nip?" And this one is a famous poem about eunuchs. Obviously, in the West, we don't have eunuchs, unless you count the doting courtiers of the American media. So, first published in the 1965 anthology Summer in Calcutta, The Dance of the Eunuchs. It was hot, so hot, before the eunuchs came to dance, wide skirts going round and round, cymbals richly clashing, and anklets jingling, jingling, jingling. Beneath the fiery gulmohar, with long braids flying, dark eyes flashing, they danced and they danced, oh, they danced till they bled. There were green tattoos on their cheeks, jasmines in their hair. Some were dark and some were almost fair. Their voices were harsh, their songs melancholy. They sang of lovers dying and of children left unborn. Some beat their drums, others beat their sorry breasts, and wailed and writhed in vacant ecstasy. They were thin in limbs and dry, like half-burnt logs from funeral pyres. A drought and a rottenness were in each of them. Even the crows were so silent on trees, and the children, wide-eyed, still, all were watching these poor creatures' convulsions. The sky crackled then, thunder came, and lightning and rain, a meagre rain that smelt of dust in attics and the urine of lizards and mice. A poem from me to you, by Komala Das, Komala Saraya, in later years, The Dance of the Eunuchs. The fiery Gulmohar, by the way, is a poinciana, so a fiery red. The smell of dust in attics and the urine of lizards, well, I think I'd almost prefer lizard urine to the variety that is palpable and pungent on the most luxurious boulevards of Midtown Manhattan and other American cities these days. Do you like dancing eunuchs? Well, they turn up in the ballet Michel Fokine and Leon Batz, made from Rimsky-Korsakov's Scheherazade, and whose lush sensuality enthralled Paris in 1910. Dancing eunuchs or not, the composer's widow did not care for it.
Thank you.
The Kirov Orchestra, conducted by Valery Gergiev and Rimsky-Korsakov's Scheherazade. On February the 23rd, 1821, John Keats died an agonizing and miserable death, far from home, in Rome, where he had gone for his health. He had tuberculosis, or consumption, as we say of poets. A year earlier, February 3rd, 1820, he had, for the first time, coughed up blood. And he knew something about that, both because he had been a dresser, an assistant surgeon, at Guy's Hospital in London, and because he had nursed his own tubercular family members. So he knew what it means to cough up blood. And as he told his friend, Charles Armitage Brown, "I know the colour of that blood. It is arterial blood. I cannot be deceived in that colour. That drop of blood is my death warrant. I must die." He was 24 when he spoke those words. There was not a lot of writing as his health declined in that final terrible year. This is believed to be the last poem John Keats ever wrote. His friend, the painter Joseph Seven, saw Keats working on it in September 1820 on the Maria Crowther, the ship taking them to Italy, from where the poet would never return. He wrote it in a volume of Shakespeare, and then, a couple of weeks before his death, presented the book to Joseph Seven. So Seven naturally assumed the poem was about him. It's far more likely to be about Fanny Brawne, the bright star of his short life. "I have two luxuries to brood over in my walks," he wrote to her. "Your loveliness and the hour of my death." If that sounds a touch overripe, well, Fanny felt the same way. She remained in mourning for 6 years and indeed mourned John Keats through all the 4 decades she survived him. Perhaps because he copied it into an anthology of Shakespeare's poetry, this is a Shakespearean sonnet. 14 lines, 3 quatrains of alternately rhymed lines, and then the final couplet. And as is traditional, there's a volta, or a switcheroo, after the 8th line, a shift in argument, a shift in perspective. In the first draft, dated to 1819, the poet was committed to love unto death. By September of 1820, that pledge was insufficient, as Keats well knew. And for the poet, the endless sleep of death is an alternative to ephemeral worldly love. The central image of the piece, the bright star, is not pressed into service for the usual poetical reasons, but only for one single aspect, its constancy. He wishes to be pillowed upon his fair love's ripening breast forever with the steadfastness of that bright star in the sky. Instead, he is the star out there in the heavens, distant but constant and loving for eternity. First published in 1838, 17 years after the author's death, in the Plymouth and Devonport Weekly Journal, a sonnet by John Keats. "Bright star, would I were steadfast as thou art, not in lone splendour hung aloft the night, and watching with eternal lids apart, like nature's patient sleepless eremite, the moving waters at their priest-like task of pure ablution round earth's human shores, or gazing on the new soft-fallen mask of snow upon the mountains and the moors. No, yet still steadfast, still unchangeable, pillowed upon my fair love's ripening breast, to feel forever its soft fall and swell, awake forever in a sweet unrest, still, to hear her tender taken breath, and so live ever, or else swoon to death. A poem from me to you, bright star, would I were steadfast as thou art, by John Keats. A 25-year-old man, wasted by impending death, can be forgiven for not being able to overcome the wretched unfairness of it all. The poet asks to be buried under a tombstone bearing no name, no dates, just the words, "Here lies one whose name was writ in water," a resentful extension of a line by the immortal Catullus. What a woman tells a passionate lover should be written in the wind and the running water. And if this lockdown ever ends and you are free to visit the Protestant cemetery in Rome, you can see that headstone with no name and those words, albeit with a preamble his friends felt obligated to add. "This grave contains all that was mortal of a young English poet who, on his deathbed, in the bitterness of his heart at the malicious power of his enemies, desired these words to be engraved on his tombstone. Here lies one whose name was writ in water. 24th February, 1821. Keats's friends are implying there that bad reviews, quote, the malicious power of his enemies, are responsible for the poor fellow's death. Lord Byron, who was no stranger to the critics' hostility, was more sanguine about such things, as he put it in response to those words. "'Tis strange the mind, that very fiery particle, should let itself be snuffed out by an article." But you never know, the composer Georges Bizet died because of two apparent heart attacks on June the 1st and then June the 3rd, 1875. The reason he had the heart attacks, however, is said to be the quote-unquote failure of his latest and, as it turned out, final work. The great opera, Carmen, opened in March to lousy reviews, and Bizet got depressed, fell ill, failed to recover, got more depressed, got more ill, and was dead within 3 months of the show's opening. At the age of 36, snuffed out by articles deploring his masterpiece's many fiery particles. Thank you. An accelerando for the ages, the dance Boheme from Bizet's Carmen, played by the Slovak Philharmonic under Antony Bramall. The 1929 Wall Street crash led to the depression worldwide, or as they say in America, the Great Depression, as FDR managed to supersize it. But the crash and its aftermath did produce quite a lot of poetry, including a piece I've always liked by Robert S. Warshaw. He was a New York intellectual, a cultural critic, which means these days you'd assume he was a man of the left. In fact, he was one of the first people to write that the, quote, idealism of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg was in fact ugly, bloody, hardcore Stalinism. He was not a man of the left. He died young, felled by a heart attack at the age of 37. Robert Warshaw wrote this piece when he was still in high school in the Bronx, a couple of years after the 1929 crash, and I like the fancy of its second line, "The Garden of Wasted Things," which, as I came to brood on it, is a somewhat paradoxical concept. A garden is there to grow things if you tend to it. But young Warshaw saw the 20s, the jazz age, as a time of material abundance utterly squandered. And you don't have to work too hard to apply that to our own time and an entire generation so mesmerized by the delights on their pocket telephones they cannot raise their heads to see our civilization and its inheritance is sliding off the cliff. So, the garden of wasted things, the idle talk that men use to waste away the hours, the lives that have been misdirected. I would say it's a bit teenagey, except that I doubt there's a teenager anywhere in the Bronx today, even before Bill de Blasio closed all the schools, who would be capable of it. So let us spend a few moments in the Garden of Wasted Things with Robert S. Warshaw. I walked one day in the Garden of Wasted Things, and there I found the bitter ghosts of all that had been spent unwisely or lost through brutal circumstance. I found the childhood that some labourer's child had never known. I found the youth that some young man had squandered. There I found some poet's genius that had gone unrecognised. I saw the ghosts of idle words and small talk that men had used to waste away the hours. I saw the hopes that had been smothered and all the dreams that never had come true and laughter that had died for lack of bread. I met with all the lives that had been misdirected, and spoke with dreary shades of loves that might have been, and songs that never had been sung. I met with all these ghosts, and many more, and each of them sat silently in the shadows, brooding over quirks of mad creation and puppets' dreams. A poem from me to you by Robert S. Warshaw. I don't believe he gave it a title other than poem. Those last words, puppets' dreams, are as striking as the Garden of Wasted Things. The 1920s was really the first decade of homogenized mass electronic media, not touring plays at your local theatre or sheet music for you to play yourself on the piano, but motion pictures and gramophone records with big stars like Rudolph Valentino and Gene Austin. And in such a world, even the fancies of our deepest sleep are not our own. Our dreams are those of puppets put there by the manufacturers of such distant delights. Gee, maybe I could get to meet Valentina if I could get to the big town and be a jazz baby dancing in a nightclub. 9 decades on, we are more solipsistic, more self-absorbed, but also dreaming the dreams of our puppet masters. Robert Warshaw, in the Garden of Wasted Things. That's no place to be buried. And it's no place for our show to wind up either. So here is a different kind of garden, courtesy of a composer I get an awful lot of requests for ever since we used his splendid Mystic Land of Egypt as the theme music for our very first Tale for Our Time, Conan Doyle's Tragedy of the Korosko. Here is Albert W. Kettleby, not in the Mystic Land of Egypt, not in a Persian market, but closer to home, in a monastery garden.
Mark Stein's Sunday Poems is a production of Mark Stein Enterprises and Oak Hill Media. All rights reserved.